Very good evening, everyone. Then, as we begin with today's session, I would like to first recite a small verse from Tedak Lingba, the founder of the Mindraling lineage, and as well as known as one of the foremost masters, treasure revealers of Tibetan Buddhism. It has always been, of course, our tradition as well as an aspiration of following the examples of these great masters that have always begun the annual retreat taking a certain verse out of his teachings. So I'm going to read the Tibetan section and then, of course, go through some amount of translation as a way of encouraging everyone to form the right motivation. Whatever you're going to do, hearing the Dharma, contemplating, reflecting, examining the Dharma, locating within that sphere of your understanding that what you find most inspiring, and taking that what is most inspiring to heart and engaging in the practice of this. Meditating, whether it is formal meditation, whether it is different kinds of contemplation that you take to heart, understanding and then putting it into practice, all of this, these different practices need to be made sure that it combines together with the right view. If the view itself is missing from the practice, then there is, speaking truthfully, not much benefit, no benefit to what you are doing. So it's extremely important when you all say things like, I love to meditate, I love my practice, or I want to meditate, or I want to meditate, I want to find out what meditation is. These are all very fine things. To anyone that you express such wishes or you say such things, it, without any argument, everyone will encourage you and say that that is the right thing to do. But while saying it, while actually thinking in such a way, whether you verbally express it or not, always make it a point, your own responsibility towards yourself, to find out what is the motivation behind that preference to meditate or not meditate. When you like Dharma, for example, why do you like Dharma? With what kind of a view are you engaging in the Dharma? The same reason here that you are in Lotus Garden this evening. Why are you here? You have to ask yourself the question. If the answer seems to be dangerously close towards following a person, one talk, a certain topic that you like, and in some of your case, by obligation, by association, by membership, because you're stuck here in some cases, you know, whatever good reason, even such a thing as truly inspired to practice, really wanting to learn the Dharma, truly understanding that this makes sense, that this is useful, whether it seems to be a good reason or whether it seems to be, as I said, dangerously close to a very sort of a, I wouldn't say superficial, but because in some ways there is a sincerity, even if it is because of a teacher or because of a certain teaching or some other kind of emotional thing, there is a lot of heartfelt warmth in it. So it's not entirely superficial, but one can't deny that it is entirely not superficial either, because there is a certain, as I said, emotional attachment to your relating to the path of the practices. So you can find a word for yourself, whatever that means, both of the shades being there. If you look into your own motivation, it will tell you a great deal about what it is that you need to overcome. If it is particularly something that is very close to an outer external experience that one enjoys, whether it is the spaciousness of meditation, whether it is a sweet-sounding theory, whether it is an inspiring talk, whether it is an inspiring figure, whether it is just that it brings so much happiness to your mind, one must cultivate strong sense of examination to go into really looking at it. It is neither bad, so bad that you feel terrible about yourself. Neither one should be so complacent as to not address it truthfully, because you owe yourself an honest approach so that you find the ground from where you are going to begin the journey of working with your own self. What is good, if you find, make it better and better. What is negative and seems to your logical, critical, analytical mind to being closer to some kind of a distortion of the ego's self-grasping tendency. Primarily, if the motivation with which you are engaging in the Dharma is a way of finding a kind of emotional happiness for yourself, or to pacify an emotional suffering and pain in your own self, then always know that you can do better, that this is the starting point. But having found the starting point, always come out of it to making it better, that it doesn't retain the same motivation. That is a responsibility that you have towards yourself. Because your mind can do better. You can truly understand its potential by not sort of fencing it and limiting it to just the fruitioning of that what seems to be the agenda with which you begin to embark on the journey, embark on the path of practice. If the starting point, your own true motivation, is not examined, then what will happen is retaining of this will make you retain every subsequent training to feed just this purpose. For your own happiness, for own freedom from suffering, to be hopeful and to sustain hope, whether it is to become learned in Dharma, whether it is a hope to one day teach Dharma, whether it is a hope to know more about Dharma, to learn more about Dharma. Because some people do relate to knowing more about Dharma just as knowing one more language, knowing another skill, out of, you know, some kind of an interest in some kind of a philosophy. Then Buddhism really doesn't go very well with this kind of a person, because Buddhism is all about training the mind, your own mind. And the training of the mind has to be engaged upon wholeheartedly, otherwise a distortion comes out of that. In the same way, whether it is to obtain something or to the fear of losing something, and therefore you allow your association with the Dharma to feed, to sustain that kind of an agenda. These, if sustained, especially what are called the eight worldly dharmas, happiness, suffering, gain and loss, hope and fear, obtaining, not obtaining, praise, blame. These are all the worldly sort of concerns that are very predominant in our habits, in our own nature. And when we allow the Dharma itself to be something that we engage in so that this can be maintained, your hope can be maintained, your fear can be maintained, can be pacified, then subsequently, as I said, every other practice will only be done with the same agenda, with the same kind of a purpose. So that is where theism grows in you. You'll become, as I always say, a great loyalist to the ideology of Buddhism. You will love Buddhism. You will love to meditate. But the love itself will never be as strong to cut through habitual patterns, discursivenesses, and the different tendencies of neurosis of the mind. And so Dharma should be always seen as a medicine that cures an illness. And the dedication with which a doctor administers the medicine and the patient does what the doctor says is the kind of attitude that must be cultivated by meditators. You see the affliction, the disease, as those unnecessary sort of faults, discursivenesses, neuroses that we have. The disease of anger, the disease of desire, the disease of ignorance, the disease of jealousy, the disease of arrogance. Start with these five. In order to rid this disease, you are applying the medicine-like Dharma to your life. Now, if in that purpose with which the teachings are given and studied, But if you hide the anger, hide the arrogance, hide the laziness, hide the attachments, hide the selfishness and the pride, and you keep piling medicine, then it is like, as all the texts say, that you have a strong sort of a rotten limb that is getting poisonous, that the gangrene is completely rotting the flesh. It needs to be really, the cause needs to be uprooted. But if you keep putting beautiful bandages on it, you know, sort of bows, ties, bows on it, have your friends sign it, you know, all of the beautiful things that you do, then if you wish, you can put a brocade covering on it also for dharma purposes, isn't it? But it doesn't really cure the disease. It is in the same way that where the mind has to be rid of all the neuroses, such a motivation, such an understanding of the right view must be integrated into the practices. When you encounter laziness, one must then say, yes, I will encounter laziness, but it is this that I have to overcome because of which I am practicing the Dhamma. When you feel the aggression, that is what you have to uproot because of which you are practicing. You can't be angrily practicing meditation. You can't be lazily trying to practice kindness. You can't be arrogantly trying to be a generous person. You know, all of those contradictions that we bring into our path of the practice is where a person may be dutifully engaged in all the outer appearances of the practices, but not necessarily allowing the teachings to go through one's own system, particularly the mind, and allow it to discern, waking the wisdom up to observe, to be able to find all the negativities that need to be eliminated and the positive qualities that need to be generated within one's own self. So the next time you encounter the difficulties, then you should be very happy. Here is the demarcation between fully engaging in the path of the practices or simply giving in to the neuroses, to the habitual patterns, and allowing the distortions to be continued. So keeping that in mind, holding the view, examining the view, holding the right view in the path of practice is important. What kind of a view should anyone have? Of course, in accordance to Tedaklingba, this great master, he says, Thame magen semjen la, ningje shenpen changsemje, mada nuju nangjengun, ramjam tabe korlor chong, semni maju nyuma la, nzenme chabdol chemborsho, kangshar tope juakun, njeme teyal rango chong, nyunmong tokso chisharyang, Tenshe chare takdo sung, dorna chija rangjin chi, tunchen trupe chedu cha sung. Tame magen, in loose translation, tame magen semjenla, towards all sentient beings who are limitless in number and as expansive as the sky. And so again, in your own mind, with working with the view of the Dharma, as a practitioner, first of all, develop the view of acknowledging the fact that you are relating towards all sentient beings. This includes one sitting next to you. Remember that. Includes the person whom you are sharing a room with. Includes the person who's going to snore tonight. Includes the person who cooks something that you're allergic to. Includes the people who are telling you to go from one place to the other place. And also includes the person who forgets to tell you the day's schedule. All of those people. In your own mind, as a meditator, first of all, develop a sense of feeling the interrelationship, codependency, and particularly this living being and many living beings, limitless and as vast, as wherever the sky is, there is a living being. And therefore, in your own mind, broadening your view, broadening your mind to encompassing and holding the presence of all these sentient beings. Ultimately, this path of practice is one that will repeatedly say, cultivate compassion for all sentient beings. Perhaps that is the reason why you chose to be on this path of practice. But you'll never be able to fulfill that fruition state if the starting itself disregards sentient beings. If itself doesn't acknowledge who it is when we mean by sentient beings. Those who are right are sentient beings. Those who are wrong are sentient beings. Those who do things correctly are sentient beings. Those who make tremendous mistakes, even the ones that are the most evil-hearted, seemingly creating lots of havoc and destruction, the worst of the worst kind of examples that you can find, is a sentient being. Take an animal that devours another animal. The dying is also a sentient being. The one killing is also a sentient being. Your heart, your mind, must be able to hold all sentient beings. So one can't just say, sentient beings, sentient beings. You have to train your mind to feel them. You have to train your mind to be actually able to go and touch base, so to speak, with the variety of different sentient beings that are there in all the different kinds of existences, and particularly learn from so many who are around you at all times. Until the heart begins to actually relate to beings as living, breathing, alive, with the same kind of hope and fear, not wanting unhappiness, wanting happiness, same kind of emotions, same kind of doubts and hesitations, goodness and badness, until your mind is able to acknowledge it, it is never going to be able to have the possibility to go beyond your own world. So this ego that we talk about, that Daglingba says, is not something else. It's not a demonic ego. Ego is the utter self-absorption, the world that you have created for yourself, where you have sort of begun to presuppose an idea that this me and then everything else. So in English you have this word called etc. So it's I and etc. So the rest of the billions of sentient beings that are there are relegated to etc. And sometimes when we're in a good mood, we call them sentient beings, isn't it? But most oftentimes, it doesn't even feel that they're there. So what happens is the horizon of your view becomes so small. The linear view that one begins to cultivate, being linear, nevertheless, is so big in its own arrogance that the rigidity immediately begins to be felt and manifests in your attitude and conduct. So the selfishness is just the product. It's the result of the self-absorption. Subsequently, all the negative kleshas, discursivenesses, anger, is to sustain this self-absorption, the linear view that does not even think of the aliveness of the others, the life of the others, where the sort of linear view so dominant with one's own self that the dot, as we say, completely sort of shadows and covers the entire space. So if you sort of begin to look through a narrow tunnel, then just that linear thing that you can see down there, if I do this, all I can see is Peter Stump right down there, isn't it? So Peter Stump becomes so big that Peter Stump becomes someone that covers the whole expanse of the space. Now the same when it does with self-absorption, instead of Peter Stump becomes me. So I become so big, although just one letter of the alphabet, but so big that eventually it doesn't see anything beyond the I's happiness, the happiness of this I, the sadness of this I, the needs of this I, whatever this I demands and expects. And so when the life becomes so dominant by this self-absorption, by your own self, then the natural ability or the natural nature of a human being to coexist with sanity, with harmony, There is coexistence. We relate with one another. But the harmony, harmoniously coexisting, relating with more peacefulness, gentleness, and patience becomes completely destroyed because of the superimposition of the self, the I, over everything. So the uncompromising self-absorption retains its rigidity even at the cost of the happiness of the others. So we don't plan to become unkind. No parent produces a child hoping it'll grow up to be an unkind person. Neither does the child plan to be unkind. Quite the opposite. We all grow up teaching each other the wisdom and the benefits of being kind. But we do the opposite, and the unkindness is naturally produced because of the linear vision that does not acknowledge the presence, the happiness, the feelings, the sameness of experiences of all other sentient beings. Therefore, towards all sentient beings, limitless as the sky is not just a simple sentence that you have heard many times. But as soon as one hears it, one must in one's own mind say, do I have that capacity? Am I doing it that way? Do I really regard all sentient beings to be truly another being as important as myself, with the gamut of expressions and experiences as I have, likewise the others do? That they all have the same kind of experiences. The kind of doubt and hesitation I experience, everybody experiences doubt and hesitation. That's what is happening at those moments where we find ourselves sort of the target of other people's aggression. They have the same kind of confusion. They have the same wants. They have the same kinds of apprehension, same struggles, same confusions, same wish to make it in this world untouched by unhappiness. Same inability to look beyond their own happiness. And therefore, when likewise all sentient beings sort of come together, then of course we can see the rampantness of ignorance, what the Buddha called ignorance as the cause of all suffering. This is then what is felt. So keeping in mind, as we say, as the line says, Tame magyun semjenam, towards all sentient beings, as limitless as the sky, what should we do? Ningje shempen changsem che, as a practitioner, the second line says, cultivate the heart of compassion and loving kindness. So now, when the mind spends time feeling the presence of all sentient beings, acknowledging the sameness of the ground of experience of all sentient beings, through that reflection, through that understanding, in your mind, what you can do is to immediately generate compassion, loving kindness, and understanding of all sentient beings. A heart, a mind that understands the pervasiveness of sentient beings and yet the sameness of the experiences of all sentient beings immediately has begun to cultivate a good ground, a fertile ground from where such excellent qualities as complete compassion or bodhicitta can arise. Later down the line, those of you who are new to Dharma, later down the line, learning about 6 kinds of paramitas, 10 kinds of paramitas, 16 classifications of that, 20 classifications of that, those are okay. They are like throwing seeds. But before those seeds are thrown, seeds of Dharma are thrown, land must be tilled. Just as a farmer, before throwing the seeds, tills the land, plows the land, makes sure that the soil is fertile. Likewise, for bodhicitta to grow, for Buddhahood to be obtained, for the liberation of all sentient beings from suffering to be freed, heart and mind of the person, this meditator, one's own self, has to be plowed, has to be tilled, has to be nurtured, and the sort of softening of that ground upon which bodhicitta, heart of compassion, the Buddha's heart, enlightened mind, can arise. Therefore, one must cultivate it with genuine compassion, genuine loving kindness. Here is, as I said earlier, not only in thought, But as you arouse that within your own mind stream, then immediately allow it to be articulated, expressed, and evidently manifest in the actions of body, speech, and mind. If there has to be a competition, then it has to be a competition of who can be better at kindness, at patience, at generosity. So that's, I think, very, very important to keep in mind. The third line says, Mada nuju nangshin kun rabjam tabe korlor jung. Expressivity to the outer is in loving kindness and compassion. So whatever energy you're going to put into the output of your concentration, output of your energy, must be in loving kindness and compassion. What can you do for yourself? Now, those people who ask, how can I be kind for myself? If all that I'm doing is for the benefit of the others, what do I gain from this? Something you really want to gain for yourself, then here it says, towards Mada Nuchu Nanjianku, towards all impure inner and outer phenomena, and that is, towards all the impure outer phenomena, they're called impure because you have given them a certain name and form. The impurity is not in the phenomena themselves. Outer phenomena are everything that your eyes can see, that your ears can hear, that you can actually taste, that you can actually feel the texture of. Whatever it is that we can see around us, the sounds that we can hear, they're all outer phenomena. By nature, none of these phenomena are anything but perfect and pure. They're all good. But the impurity comes because you have designated them with a term, with a name, with a form, that allows them to be so limited in what you have named that you have impeded their freedom to be whatever it is. Like the sound, if you hear. By nature, the sound of the air condition is good as it is. Those who are feeling disturbed by it, either because of the texture of it, how you feel, or because of the ears, how you hear. And then when the ears and then the texture begins to be heightened, you become aware of the form. That form leads you to a person who made it, built it, put it on, put it off, whatever it is. So all the names and forms have begun to be exaggerated. And plus on that, you either like it or you don't like it. So you express your emotion about it. So the impurity comes because you impute name, form, personal preferences or non-preferences. And so you've limited that completely. You haven't given it the freedom to be. Your mind has imposed upon it a certain kind of a designation. And the impurity gets worse when someone insists it be shut off and the half of the room wants it to be put on. We've had that. So this I'm talking about, those of you who don't know what I'm talking about, is an experience we've all had, isn't it? Those without hair like us, we like it off certain times. Then those of you who have more hair on your head, then like it on at all times. So we've had this over the years, lots of sort of movements around where you will probably find one put off, two put off, one put on, second one put on, lots of nodding and winking happening at all those times. Now, what the impurity is happening over here is not that, but that all the neurosis that comes with it, that makes it impure. And there's, of course, certain times when we feel very angry about it. Why was it done in the first place? Why wasn't it done earlier? So, why was it done in blue? Why couldn't it be red, a dharma color? Gordon, who is responsible with this, has heard, I think, dozen expressions and opinions about it. And so he's learned to say, yes, you're right. But likewise, this is then with everything. Taste and how much we have captured, sort of how much we have seized it. Forms, how much we have seized it. How many are things that we don't like at all. How many are things that we like terribly. Two people drive up in the car, one you know, one you don't know. So immediately you don't give freedom for both of them to be human beings. You hug the one and you ignore the other one completely. That's what brings in the impurity. The impurity is the imputation, the kind of sort of many different kinds of characteristics that you pile and because of which everything becomes fragmented. And nothing is allowed to be able to give them the freedom as a whole. Now, overall, what does that do? It makes the mind rigid, more and more rigid. Because all the things that you like become categorized in one group. All the things that you do not like become categorized in one group. And eventually, the rigidity is the fostering ground for aggression, competitiveness, likes and dislikes, partialities, biases, discriminations. And so this world of discrimination, where discrimination is exaggerated, of course, it will bring about so strong a duality that the karma, that the causes that are created will always be that which brings about a lot of suffering to oneself and the others. So all of the unhappy things, all of the violences, all of the hatred, all of the inabilities of human beings to coexist harmoniously, all those situations are resultant states of a discrimination. Discrimination bred by preferences. Preferences where the domination of one's own likes and dislikes based upon what you have then sort of captured as your form, as the things that you like of the form, what forms you do not like, sounds you do not like, and so forth. Therefore, mada nuchu nangyengun, here the Daglimba says, towards all impure inner phenomena and outer phenomena. We spoke about outer phenomena. Inner phenomena are emotions. You feel very sad, and then with that one sad thought, you spend the next 24 hours feeling miserable. That is where you've taken one thought, captured it, exaggerated it, deliberated it to such a degree that it's sort of grown from one simple thought to completely overshadow whatever happiness that you can experience throughout the day. One anger has that same kind of power. One irritation, one goodness, one badness, whatever it is. But thoughts, when not given the freedom to be a thought, but continuously colored and put flavors in with your own self-absorbed mind, will often make what is by nature pure, impure. So impure thoughts, impure phenomena, inner phenomena. So here the Daglingba says, as a meditator, what should you do? Just as outer expressivity has to be in loving kindness and compassion, internally, as a meditator towards all impure outer phenomena and inner phenomena, as it arises, rabjam thape kholorjong, purify these within the infinite pure will. Thapa rabjam kholorjong, infinite pure will. Now, pure will is a big explanation. We can probably do a whole retreat on the word pure will. But to keep it, summarize it short. Pure will essentially means your mind, that which is continuously turning, that which is continuously active. And so here, purify it within the infinite pure will is not to have a sense of, or not to give in to the sense of changing what is outer phenomena and inner phenomena. But train your own mind to allowing all that what arises as inner phenomena, outer phenomena, to simply be pure within. Purify within the infinite wheel. Purify it within your own mind. And the purifying comes when one doesn't grasp to it, when one doesn't exaggerate to it. Whatever arises, can you give everything the freedom to be what it is when you wake up tomorrow? Can you give mountain the freedom to be a mountain, birds to be birds, people to be people, the boiled egg to be a boiled egg? Isn't it? Can you give your thoughts of happiness just as a thought, thoughts of sadness to be a thought, irritation to just be a thought, inspiration to be just a thought, spirituality to just be a thought, samsara to be just a thought? Can you train your mind to non-exaggerating things as they arise within the scope, within the sphere of your own awareness. And in that way, live for a moment and think. Without your active participation in bringing about an exaggeration, do things by themselves have the energy or the power to becoming aggravated? If you did not keep fueling a thought, would it become itself, by itself, able to be exaggerated into a full-blown anger? Without your fueling any kind of a thought, tainting it with a sense of pride, by its own self, does the thought have the capacity to itself becoming arrogance or pride? Your participation is needed. You have to think about it. You have to sustain it in your mind. You have to think about all past things that happened, future things that will not happen, now things where things are not justified, what you did not get, what you did not obtain. You have to look at it. Then you have to find reasons why that other person is confused or disturbed or wrong or right or whatever it is. And so those are the participations. You add on to that. You add to that one single thought 100 different other thoughts. That exaggerates it, and therefore that makes whatever arises impure. So here it is, therefore it says, Madhanuju, to all that arises in your own mind stream as you are experiencing all inner and outer phenomena, whatever arises within your own self, within your own mind, purify by not grasping to them. Let it be. Don't indulge it. Don't exaggerate it. Don't add to it. Don't continually dig into it. Allow yourself to let be. Semyi maji nyumala, without altering, without fabricating, this innate mind, that what you have sat in, a mind that is giving outer and inner phenomena the freedom to be, to that attitude where you release everyone, where you liberate everything to be as it is, continually remain without altering, without fabricating. In simple words, familiarize yourself in that state where you give others the freedom to be. Familiarize yourself to rest, resting restfully, resting happily and calmly, without altering that calm state, fabricating that calm state. Zinme chabdal chambursho, remain within this expanse, free of any grasping. And so, it says, to all sentient beings limitless as sky, cultivate the heart of compassion and loving kindness towards all impure inner and outer phenomena that arises. Purify within the infinite, pure wheel, without altering, fabricating this innate nature of mind, remain within this expanse, free of any grasping. Kanshar tobe juwagun, whatever arises as movement of the mind, whatever arises. Now when you're trying to remain without altering, without fabricating, in that quietness of the mind, in that stillness of the mind that is trying to give others the freedom to be, kanshar tobe juwagun, whatever arises, in that calm mind, whatever arises is a movement of mind. So simply see it as a movement of mind. You're not dead. It's going to be alive. Senses are intact. It's going to see things. So what, when you're seeing things, you're seeing things. When you're hearing things, you're hearing things. These are just the normal activeness of one's own mind. These are simply the movement of one's own mind. Jeme teyal rangochong, without deliberating, sustain this one's own face. Rangochong is the word here in Tibetan, which says one's own face, which means one's own nature. One's own nature. Just as your face is your own self, likewise, without deliberating, This calm state is your own nature. This is who you are. This is therefore your own nature. Sustain that. Nyonmong tokso chishariang. Whatever kleshas arise, anger, ignorance, desire, arrogance, jealousy, or any other gross and subtle discursivenesses, kleshas arise. Tenshe chare taoto chong. With vigilance, with mindfulness, like that of a watchman, someone who's a sort of a, if you designated a person to be a watchman, watching the gate, guarding the gate, like a police. And then, with vigilance and mindfulness, like a watchman, guard your mind, observe your mind, watchfully look at your own mind. These two lines, whatever kleshas arise, with vigilance, mindfulness, like a watchman, guard your mind, is then post-meditation. When you are engaged in action, it is there that the kleshas are most rampant, and one easily falls back into the habitual patterns of different kinds of emotions that you play with, become exaggerated, become expressed in many different ways. At such moment, watch yourself. Be very vigilant. Just as a watchman who is entrusted with guarding a property watches carefully inside and out, likewise, watch your own mind, how it functions, how it reacts, how it is, again, succumbing to the habit of exaggeration. Carefully be vigilant, carefully observe your own mind. In short, as the Dalai Lama says, whatever actions are performed, practice so that this may repay the kindness of all sentient beings. In short, whatever you do, whether it is the practice of loving kindness and compassion, whether it is watching the nature of your own mind and stillness of your own meditation, whether it is sense of generation of awareness, whatever you do, eliminating discursivenesses, three root poisons, whatever it is that you do, however, bind them all together with the single motivation. Whatever I do it so that I can repay the kindness of all sentient beings. So therefore, all effort is a bodhicitta. Your making the effort to be here is bodhicitta. Your going through the rigors of practice and study is bodhicitta. Your sitting in meditation every minute is an expression of kindness. Every effort that you make in trying to even learn these words that are new to some of you, that's also kindness. The kindness, however, becomes pure kindness that you are able to then give as a gratitude, expression of gratitude to the kindness of all sentient beings. However, can only happen when it is joined with an awareness. Now, accidentally it will become kindness, that is not going to happen. That is going to be, that effort that you put into will be a kindness for sentient beings if it joins your mind that wishes all sentient beings to be freed from the suffering through the exertions that you put into it. So, sort of simplifying it by saying, whatever I put into it, will it always be something beneficial for the sentient beings, even if I am not aware of it? No. Then there is not much power. That is going to be heavily dependent upon accidental fruition of some kind. You have to be on the driving seat. You have to be able to take the path to the direction, with the vigilance, with the awareness of your own mind. Then, whatever effort that you are generating is going to be a service, an expression of repaying the kindness of all mother-like sentient beings. Is that clear? And so, hearing that you are doing, is it virtuous? It can be virtuous if you're aware of it. But if you are hearing something, making sense of it, But if the awareness of what you are hearing is not there, then there is not much benefit to it. So the hearing becomes secondary to the awareness. Likewise, you're sitting in meditation. Is it an expression of kindness to other sentient beings? No, if the awareness is not there. Because the body is just doing an action at that moment. And no matter how virtuous that action may seemingly be like, it is absent of the awareness. But if the awareness is brought into the action, then it is giving it a direction. Therefore, that direction makes it much more effective in being able to becoming a seed of goodness for self and the others. So because of that, is an action outside of a shrine room, such as walking down the road, beneficial for sentient beings? Yes, if the awareness is there, then that simple action of walking down the road is more beneficial for sentient beings than perhaps 2 hours of sitting in a shrine room, like a bear hibernating, isn't it? Or a bird sitting in the nest. Cozy, comfortable, but without any kind of a genuine awareness. The mind is not alert. The mind is not aware. And therefore, that is then another, no action different than perhaps sleeping. So when we grew up, our teachers used to say, where there is an inner absorption and a dullness of the mind that is not aware, or distraction, where the awareness is not there in meditation, why put yourself up to so much of difficulty? Go down, go and lie down in the bed, go to sleep. At least physically, you'll feel a little bit more happier, isn't it? Here you sit in meditation, but if the awareness itself is missing, then, you know, physically you're tired, spiritually you haven't obtained anything, and what is a sentient being supposed to do with you? Make a poster out of your meditation posture or what? There's no benefit. So the core quality is to cultivate that awareness. The awareness supported by loving kindness to the others. There is tremendous amount of awareness required for that. Awareness that it watches your relationship to phenomena. That it is able to free, the awareness is strong enough to free it from unnecessary exaggeration and deliberation, allowing you to experience more expansive abiding within your own fundamental nature of your own mind. That same awareness taken into action, conduct of body, speech, and mind, that which will allow you to bring in a semblance and a non-gap between meditation and post-meditation attitude. Therefore, generating such an alertness, such an awareness is absolutely necessary. So when that kind of an awareness is generated and strengthened, then definitely yes, all actions will be able to be in sort of tandem or carrying the essence of the Dhamma practices. And that is how one must engage, one must practice. So much for tonight. From tomorrow morning, then I will begin with the topic of closer to the Pratitya Samudapada, or the interdependent origination.